So comedian George Carlin once had a comedy routine many, many years ago where he had, I think it was the 7 words that you cannot say on TV or radio. And then a few years later, he updated this with a few additions and he upped that list to 95 or something along those lines. I don't remember what the exact number was. But within this new list, he had a phrase that has actually kind of entered the lexicon, or at least partially. And that phrase was Mongolian clusterfuck. And I think like a lot of people, I looked at that and said this was a phrase that he'd made up entirely for the comedy routine, not really realizing that there was a real application to this phrase, that this had a very distinctive descriptive power, or usage, I guess I should say. And that is in referring to the traffic in the roads in South Jersey. I recently had to take a business trip back up to Jersey, and I say back up because I was actually born there. And I lived there until I was 7 years old before I moved to central New York. And the business trip, I had to get some things taken care of. It wasn't the business as in the photography business. So I was not actually doing any shooting. In fact, the opportunities to do shooting were extremely limited. And not just from time, but mostly from the idea that South Jersey is ugly. Ugly. U-G-L-Y. Ugly. It is not a pretty area. It is definitely way over-industrialized and overdeveloped. And it even was, or was certainly getting that way when we left there, when our family left there. I left there first. I went up to New York. I kind of, checked out things in New York to see how things were going on. I was kind of the guinea pig, like the canary in the coal mine, to see what New York was like. And then I gave the rest of the family the all clear because I was still alive and hadn't been molested or anything. But anyway, I had never driven all that much in South Jersey. Well, of course, I was 7, so I didn't drive at all as far as my parents knew. But I went up to New York and I learned how to drive there. Sometime after 7 years old, actually. And, did most of my driving in New York. I did a few trips down to Jersey, but even then the driving was limited. So this was my first time back and having to drive around a lot in different areas, trying to find some things. And I have to say that I am not the better for the experience. Actually, I think there's brain cells that are probably missing. But it is a really ugly, as I said, Mongolian clusterfuck. It really is. It's an ugly-ass area. They have not done a very good job with the roads. There are, I think, some nice areas in Jersey, but I think most of the state is like this. But certainly the area I was in, the South Jersey, was heavily industrialized, had been for a long time. One of the things that they had there were like tank farms, and they've been there for a long time. This is right across the river from Philadelphia, and there's a lot of petroleum interests that are in the area. And a tank farm is a vast trucks of land, as they say. But it's a vast area where they have these very big petroleum storage tanks, or just fuel oil or whatever, something petroleum related, let's put it that way. And they're just, big tanks that are all over the place. And so even in green areas, or you think what might be a green area, all of a sudden you see all these white tanks rising out of the landscape. They're not rising, they're holding still. But they're there. They have appeared, as you're around the bend in the road. But there's a lot of things that Jersey has that it's kind of notorious for, I think. And this was a big reminder that how different roads are in different areas of the world or different areas of the United States. I can't speak for the world. I haven't been in the world. I've been in the United States and primarily East Coast. And in fact, about 3 states. And I'm not very well traveled at all and can't really talk about this. So take all this with a grain of salt. But anyway, getting on. Jersey is kind of fond of traffic circles. And I think they've reduced them a bit since the last time I was there. I think they cut some of them out. But that's a fairly common thing that you will see around there. They have a lot of what we call spaghetti junctions, which is a lot of different roads all converging from the same area. And the cluster of on-ramps and lanes and turn lanes and all this that have to be there to... You come in off of Route 1 and you want to get to Route 5 without going through Route 2, 3, and 4, and so they have all these different ways that you can go around it that supposedly are making traffic better and failing entirely, completely and utterly. New Jersey really needs some engineers to go through and like a few thousand bulldozers to just kind of get rid of all the fucking roads that they have there right now and do it again right. And there's another thing that's very, I think it's peculiar to Jersey. This is the only place I've ever seen it. And in fact, it's very limited areas and it's bizarre. And it's this little thing called a jug handle. Now, a jug handle is it's an off-ramp not off of an interstate or anything like that, where you would think you would need an off-ramp to kind of keep traffic flowing. No, you're approaching a four-way intersection with a traffic light, and then they have a little sign up there with completely inadequate notice ahead of time to say, all turns go right. Now, you wanted to make a left turn, but you better be over in the right lane and take this little off-ramp to the right. Again, this is a regular road. There's no reason for an off-ramp. It's not raised. It's not anything. It's a four-lane road, perhaps. But you cut over to the right to connect to the crossroad, the one that you wanted to get on, but you're getting on it from the right instead of turning onto it onto the left, to connect to it there, and then go through the intersection that you were just approaching, but this time going perpendicular to your travel. So you have to get off of the road that you were going to cross the road that you were on, rather than simply making a left turn like every normal place in the rest of the goddamn world does. And these are very cute. I'm going to have to find a little clip of a map to show you what a jug handle is, just to attach it to this post to see. It's this very strange thing. And of course, again, we're talking heavy traffic in Jersey, and we're talking, they do these on fairly major thoroughfares. So if you are not prepared for these, if your GPS isn't giving you proper indications, or if you're just following a paper map, I don't know if anybody does that anymore, but if you're just following a straightforward map, or if you've just kind of memorized the directions, and you're saying, I'm going to have to take a left up here pretty soon, you are, chances are, in the left lane, if you're smart, and not like, well, I don't know, about a third of the drivers out there that can't figure out what lane they should be in, even though they're about to make a turn. But you're in the left lane and getting ready, perhaps to pull off on a little turn-only lane to the left. And then you see this sign with no warning that says, all turns to the right. And of course, the right lane is already jammed full of traffic, and there's no fucking way you're getting over there. So you end up kind of blowing through your intersection and having to go past and make a U-turn anyway. So this is the thing that jug handles do, is that they make traffic better somehow. I'm not sure exactly how. But they do something. Somebody thought it was necessary. I'm guessing that there are a lot of people that owned asphalt stock or something when they were doing designing, because they added in all these extra little things. There are some very strange things in Jersey and driving, let me tell you something. And it's not delightful. There was another interesting visual thing that really drove it home. I was driving on 295, and 295 is a major north-south route in Jersey off of, you know, it's a spur of 95, which is the major north-south route along most of the East Coast. And 295 had this one section right near where I was, where the road split, and there were spurs that were going off to the bridges that crossed over the river into Philadelphia. Of course, as you can imagine, very busy roads here. And for some reason, they decided that 295 had to make some really sharp bends right here. And I think they wanted it to kind of turn and bear off a little bit more east, make an almost 90-degree turn. And this is a fairly common thing on, I won't say fairly common, this happens on interstates from time to time, where they say, all right, well, we actually want to turn just about 90 degrees away from the way we're going right now because of geography or whatever. And so they'll make a broad turn over a period of, you know, maybe 1,000 meters that they take this time to make this broad turn. But that wasn't going to work for 295, so what they ended up doing was putting in this rather distinctive S-curve, a rather sharp one, especially for an interstate. You recognize that this is an interstate, and the speed limit is running somewhere around, you know, 100 kilometers per hour, or about, you know, 65 miles per hour. And this is why interstates exist, so that you can have high-speed flow, you know, through traffic that continues flowing. You know, in most cases, not at rush hour and not, you know, around Baltimore and Washington at all and things like that. But then they put in this broad curve and they drop the speed limit down to about 55 kilometers per hour, 35 miles an hour, which is, you know, it cuts speed in half. Big curve, of course, stay in lane. And I remember seeing this as I approached this in these signs, and I'm going, are you serious? 35 miles an hour? What the hell is going on with this? And then you see all the little arrows that say, you know, you're making a big turn to the left. And remember, I did say it was, did I say? It was, 295 was turning to the right then, but the first thing they had to do was make it turn to the left, because the right turn wasn't going to be sharp enough, so they had it turn left. So they made this left turn, and around the outside edge of this turn, there was the standard concrete barriers, the kind that you find in between lanes, that were, about a meter high, and that followed the curve around. There was a little bit of a shoulder. And then beyond that, there was a barrier, and I don't know whether it was a retaining barrier or a sound barrier, or literally a crash barrier or something like that. But that one was a good 6 to 8 meters high. And running around this barrier, first of all, the concrete barrier, the low one, was completely covered with tire marks. There had plenty of people that had hit that and had been chewing up their sidewalls or their tires along that thing. But then on the big barrier, up on the high one, at about the height of the top of a semi-trailer, there was a set of gouges that ran for about 50 meters around that. And you could see very clearly that some trucker had come through there too fast, perhaps late at night and he was tired, perhaps he was texting, wasn't paying attention, or perhaps he was just driving on an interstate and expecting, implausibly, that interstate traffic would be nice and smooth and not heavy turns or anything like that, because that's the way they're fucking designed. And he had caught this thing, and he had dragged this truck down this barrier for some distance, tipped up on two wheels, and probably making one hell of a racket. But that was a very visual thing. I'm kind of sorry I couldn't get a picture of it, but there was no way in hell I was going to stop and try and get the camera out through this thing. And you no sooner get through this turn, by the way, than they decide to turn, and they're going to make you go in the opposite direction. Now you have to do a right turn. Now, they didn't need the barriers on the right turn because they'd already slowed down or wrecked half of the cars that were going too fast through there. So then they didn't need the big barrier going the other way. But bearing in mind that this started out with two lanes, they merged a lane in immediately after the first turn and barrier, and then merged another two lanes in from the other side as it's going around and cutting to the right. This is 295 in Jersey. This is their idea of good engineering. It was kind of scary. One of the things I noticed while being in Jersey that there's a lot of... Well, first of all, if you're looking up anything, you're going to find there's a different town all over the place. There's a different town pretty much every mile, but it's not a town, okay? It's a township or a borough, one or the other. New Jersey has some of the old-style naming of their locations. And so... most of the places are either townships or boroughs, and these are abbreviated on the signs as you run into them. And literally, you will see these like every mile. They are abbreviated as TWP or BORO. And so you'll go from, and you'll see, you're in the borough of Belmar, and then you enter the township of Deptford. Well, you don't from Belmar, but anyway. But just to give you an idea, that's just kind of the way Jersey is. Now, the one thing I am going to say, I'm not going to be completely negative about Jersey because there is one little thing that I did actually manage to accomplish, and I had tried this numerous times. But growing up there, one of the things that I grew up with was hoagies. Now, hoagie is kind of a local term for that general area for what is sometimes called what is usually called a sub in other locations, or occasionally a grinder or poor boy or blah, 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 blah. But anyway... a very long lunch meat sandwich on an entire loaf of bread that you split in half, and then you have this thing, and it ranges in length anywhere from 6 inches to about 14 or 15. And in the South Jersey, in the Philadelphia area, there is a particular way of making these, of making hoagies, that is distinctive, and I had never run into it anywhere else. And we moved up to New York, and we went and said, let's get a hoagie. Well, first of all, we couldn't find hoagies anywhere. We had to settle for subs. And we're thinking, they're the same thing. It's a long lunch meat sandwich. And no, they were not. They're not the same thing at all. There's some distinctive differences. And in that entire time, we're talking about, I moved away from Jersey in 1973. And there was a gradual realization that I had not had a hoagie in years. And since then, I have actually been on a quest for a proper Philadelphia-style hoagie. I talk to people about these sometimes when they're from the area. One time I had a flight, and I had a layover in Philadelphia, and they had, in the airport, they had a hoagie shop. It was actually identified as a hoagie. I'm like, you're going to do it right. And no, they fucking didn't. They did a basic sub. In fact, it was worse than your basic Subway sub. I'm not saying Subway subs are particularly bad, but there's nothing exciting about them. So I was on a quest, and I talked to a couple different people. I stopped at one place and had one, and it was pretty close, but it wasn't quite right. And then I talked to somebody, and he recommended a place, in fact, in Belmar called Carmen's. I'll go ahead and tell you about this. It's on Browning Street in Belmar. And they did it right. And they did fucking huge hoagies. They had a great big damn thing. And that was a proper hoagie. I ended up having to bring some of it home with me. First of all, because this was two meals at least for a big eater. If you could eat that all in one meal, you were, as the guy that told me about it said, you're not going to eat anything for the rest of the day. But I wanted the girlfriend to try it too. And I'd like all you to try it too, but you got to get over here really quick because there's not much left. The other thing about this trip was driving hell. I'm going to say this without a doubt. It was only out for a few days and I managed to catch bad traffic both ways. I was trying to beat the holiday weekend and did for the most part. But I did catch Washington, you know, D.C. area, about at rush hour, and had to do the D.C. to Baltimore run, which is always a heavily traveled road, through rush hour. And it was kind of a mess. And it did occur to me that I have to put some money together and open a body shop in the D.C. area, or a wrecker service, one or the other. Because the amount of skid marks and the amount of little bits of pieces of cars on the side of the road and the amount of damaged barriers in this stretch between Washington and Baltimore told me that I would, you know, become a millionaire very quickly. There's a lot of traffic. And part of the problem with this are the people that don't understand the dynamics of a traffic jam and what it's like. Now, you know, you get too many cars on the road and traffic slows down and it gets backed up and it's very frustrating. And I understand this. I get as frustrated as anybody else. But the problem with getting frustrated about things is that oftentimes makes people do something stupid and they think that they can burn off this frustration if they find some magic little activity and they're going to get into clear traffic. And I love the thinking of this because traffic can be backed up for kilometers. But they think that if they change lanes right now and jump over here, this is the faster moving lane that nobody's really noticed is actually going faster and is going to go twice as fast as all the stopped cars in the other two lanes. And so they think they're going to get over there, or, you know, they just get frustrated and they dart in front of somebody else. And because they're pissed, they kind of, you know, they think everybody else is causing the bad traffic for them, that they're not part of it. And so they're going to jump out and take it out on other people, especially people that are already behind them or something, or, you know, just happen to be over in the other lane minding their own business. And so there's a lot of this lane changing stuff and a lot of darting around and things. People that don't realize that they're the ones causing the accidents, largely because A, they've just cut off following distance for people, you know, that they just cut in front of, or B, they've gunned the gas and then they don't have the proper amount of time to stop when, of course, something else happens, like traffic stops again, because that's what happens in traffic jams. It moves forward a little bit, and then it stops. And there isn't this magic portal. People seem to think that there is this thing that if they get in the right place, all of a sudden, they're going to be transported out of a traffic jam and into smooth and open and empty roads. And it is kind of funny. It's this obsessive appearance from people to see them doing this and that they go, oh, no, over here. No, over here. Maybe it's over here. Oh, I'll find it. I know. I'll just have to hit it a certain way. I just have to stand sideways and wiggle my ear as I change lanes right in front of somebody else. But it's kind of interesting. And the standard thing about a traffic jam, and it was kind of funny watching this one too. The first thing that I noticed, because I had been in this traffic for over an hour, for kilometers, for a very long period of time, it was moving. But it was moving like slower than most city traffic moves. And the one thing that I noticed was that I saw the same cars over and over and over again. And it didn't matter which lane they were in. It did not matter whether they had passed me or I had passed them. It didn't matter whether they were one of the ones that was trying to dart around in lanes. I was still constantly seeing them. And that just basically says everything you need to know about a traffic jam is there is no magic formula. Just wait and you will get through it. But I was watching this one particular person that was feeling very anxious and was constantly changing lanes, thinking that as soon as he saw traffic moving in one particular lane, he was going to jump into it and, you know, get through things faster, and he was going to at least get a car length ahead or something. Not really realizing that the basic thing of a traffic jam is that You move forward a little bit, and then you slow down and you stop. That's how it goes. It goes in little surges. It's very hard for traffic to keep flowing. So the moment you change lanes into one that seems to be moving, it's going to stop. The one that you just abandoned is now going to start moving, but you're out of it now. So I actually watched this guy who was coming up, not just maintaining the same speed as all other traffic. He was actually going slower because he kept changing into the lanes just before it stopped. It was amusing to watch as he dropped further and further behind me. And my intention wasn't to sit here and talk about traffic jams and traffic in Jersey and all that kind of stuff, even though I had to get it off my chest. Let's tell you, this was the primary thing about this trip. There was very little. I did not really take pictures. But I am going to talk a little bit about the curious thing of computers and what's happened with computers. This all comes back to photography, trust me. Personal computers, many years ago, had a bunch of different interface ports that were on there for doing different things. They had parallel ports that were intended for printers, and they had two different kinds of serial ports that would connect to different peripherals, including your mouse. And eventually they began switching over, and to me, it still seems recent, but I think they started to switch something like 20 years ago. I remember Windows 98 wasn't quite set up to do this, and you had to download drivers, but they started switching over to USB ports, universal serial bus ports. And instead of having 21 pins or 9 pins or anything like that, it was basically just a standard 4-pin connection. And they managed to run everything off of this. And keyboards switched over to this, and mice switched over to this, and printers switched over to this. And now every computer has nothing but USB ports, and there's very rarely any other port that's on there or any other port that's needed. Meanwhile, as cell phones came up, cell phones initially were just the kind of little flip phones and stuff. A lot of them had their proprietary chargers. And if you have an iPhone, you still have a proprietary charger because that's what Apple does to you. But they had proprietary chargers and they were all their own design so that you would only buy stuff from them. But as smartphones started coming up, as they started coming up and as it got to the point where you actually had to interface with a computer to transfer, files or to your address book or something along those lines, they began standardizing over to USB as well. And this is kind of where this comes up, because this is the technology catching up with the thing that I wanted to accomplish. When doing macro photography, one of the things that I need quite often is a bit of light to throw on the subject, actually sometimes a lot of light. And there's a couple of reasons for this, one of which is that many of my macro subjects just aren't in very good light in the first place, and I'm trying to see them clearly enough to focus. The other is the lens that I'm using right now. One of the lenses that I'm using right now, I should say, for high magnification is a reversed 28 to 105 millimeter. If you take a wide angle lens and you put it on the camera backwards, it becomes a very high magnification lens. And this one had failed on me some time back. The aperture had stopped working. And I tried it out backwards and thought, hey, this worked really good. So I opened it up and pulled out the aperture motor and fixed the aperture over to f16 because A, it wasn't working in the first place, but B, backwards, it's not going to work because the electronic connections aren't really there. So I fixed this over to f16, but when it's fixed at f16, that's fairly dark in the viewfinder, so you need a lot of light on the subject just to be sure that you're in focus. And forget autofocus, it's strictly manual focus, and even on this, you're not even moving the focus ring, you're moving yourself. You're moving the whole camera till it's at the right distance, because we are talking the focus, the sharp focus range is a millimeter, literally a millimeter, perhaps less, but it is literally a millimeter. And even at f16, the depth of field is still only a few millimeters. So it has to be very specific, and because it's so dark in the viewfinder, there has to be a lot of light. So this is what I'm getting to. I needed some bright lights, and I've tried a bunch of different rigs to do this, because it has to be aimed in a very specific area right in front of the lens. And this is kind of hard to do. I've tried headlamps. And then the camera itself, or the lens, or the flash unit, will actually get in the way and block the headlamp. And, I try and move it over to the side, and that doesn't quite work. And I had a little rig that I'd made, a little homemade thing, which ran off of two AA batteries. That was a little gooseneck lamp with an LED bulb on the end. And this LED fixture had been intended for the AA size maglite flashlights. It was a modification to change it from the incandescent bulb to an LED bulb. And I had this on there, and it wasn't too bad. The gooseneck let it aim the way it was. But it went through the batteries kind of quickly, and it would get dimmer. And I couldn't really lock down the battery unit someplace to where it was nice and firm, to where it wouldn't move and it wouldn't shift. And this was a very frustrating thing, was trying to have it attached to something to where it would stay put, and of course allow me to change the batteries. But it occurred to me just recently that maybe all of the things were coming together right now the way it was. With cell phones, and we go back to the cell phones, we talk about the USB ports. The primary things about cell phones now is that there are external power sources for when your batteries are running low. And it's just a little thing. You plug your regular phone charger, your USB charger, into the USB port of this little battery pack, and you've got some emergency battery power. And I found in researching these that most of them seem to use the same style of battery, which is an 18650. It's a new type of rechargeable battery, or 18650 if you like. But it's a rechargeable battery with fairly high milliamp hours on it, and runs about 3.7 volts. And so most of these little battery packs just seem to be using these. Well, I already had several of these because I was using these in like the tactical flashlights I have, the medium-small flashlights. Again, very bright LEDs, but too heavy to try and strap to the camera and aim in a particular direction. But I just got a little case for one of these that would convert it over to having a USB port, as well as being able to recharge off a USB, you know, and plug it into the computer and go from there. So I got one of these, and the next step, or the next part of it, I got all these actually together, I ordered them all together. But the next part of it was a flexible gooseneck USB extension. That's probably, well, I don't know how many millimeters. You'll see the pictures of it. You can judge for yourself. But basically, it's a stiff gooseneck, and it could plug into the little battery pack and then aim wherever you wanted, as long as the battery pack was tacked down nice and tight. And then the third part was just basically an LED bulb with a USB plug on it. And they were intended, you could plug it into your cell phone if you had a full-size USB, but it would plug into these little battery packs, or maybe just into the computer, or into a USB extension cord, whatever. But it's just a basic little LED light, but pretty focused and very bright. And these three things together brought together what I needed for the macro rig, and this was a handy little thing. Now, not everybody is going to find a use for this. I talk about this partially just out of curiosity, out of anybody else's curiosity, but just to talk about some of the hack rigs. I actually hate the word hack, I shouldn't use that. Some of the rigs that a photographer will do to accomplish things that they do on a regular basis. Not every photographer does the same thing, of course. And in some cases, they find that they're looking for some, you know, they're trying to do something in particular. They're looking for some bit of equipment that's going to work specific to their specialty. And this is, as I said, I've been trying this for a while before I finally got this together, before the technology caught up with me. You may see going back in some of the other posts, or if I have them linked down below, some of the other modifications that I've done, mostly to the flash lighting rigs, the strobe lighting that I have to use for macro work, and especially a soft box modifier on there to spread the light out and diffuse it a little bit and not make it as sharp and spotlighty. Now, the USB light is a spotlight, but it doesn't really show in the picture. It's a lower light level than the flash is going to be. It can also be moved in about the same angle as the flash, just inside it, so that it actually will show largely the same shadows that I'm going to get from the photo. And this is a modification that I may end up doing where I actually mount the light inside or on the backside of the softbox unit, so it is aiming exactly where the flash unit is going to be. So no matter how I aim the flash, if the light is falling on the subject where I'm, you know, where I'm focusing in the lens, if the light is falling there, then I know the flash is going to be falling the same way. It's going to be illuminating the subject in the same manner, even though as a softbox, it's going to be more diffuse and spread out. But it'll give me an idea of the right angle and whether I can actually see or whether I'm going to be throwing shadows on a key subject. Now, you may find that this is actually useful for you and you can put this together yourself. I really only spent a few dollars on this whole rig to put this together, and it works very well. And the only thing that I had to do to stabilize it some more, I have a little zip tie, releasable zip tie, that pins it down, because where the gooseneck plugged into the battery pack, it's not a real tight USB connection. It's not as firm as it could be, and so there's a little play. And so that meant that play would be magnified out by the length of the gooseneck and could move around just a little bit too much. But putting that zip tie on it pinned that end down so that it wouldn't move much. And you see it's kind of wrapped around the arm that holds the flash, so that's a little bit more stability. So it aims where I want it to aim. And does it work? Yes. You're going to see some pictures that are down there. And as I say in the text, these were shot in total darkness. I went into the bathroom, shot all the lights off, and just used the light from the lamp. And the focus is very, very short. So, of course, focus had to be very precise. So I had to be able to see it very clearly. So, yes, this works quite well. The 18650 battery seems to last more than adequate amount of time to be out at night shooting without, you know, the batteries running down too quickly. The only thing I think it's missing is a little switch, is a little on and off switch, because in order to shut the light off, you have to actually unplug it from the USB. And I think that's the one thing I would like would be a switch, and I could actually wire that in if I wanted to. May end up doing it. But it is a handy little thing. It's been very useful. If you get some use out of this, that's fine. If you don't, it's just kind of a reflection of going, if there's something that you specialize in as a photographer, if there's something that you're doing, chances are you're going to have to put something together yourself. And being creative and looking around and just trying to find something can help you a whole lot. And there's a lot of things out there. As I said, I ordered these off of eBay for a few bucks. Most of them came from, I think all of them came from China. I'm not sure. But there's a lot of little things there that are very inexpensive, and there's no reason for them to be expensive. There's no reason for them to be anything cool. It's just, look, it's a LED bulb with a USB connection. Okay, big deal. But you can find these things and put together something that works very well for you and lets everything become that much easier for you, which is, you know, a useful thing. It's helpful. That's it for now. I know I haven't been posting very much. I'm going to try and build that up right now, but I have been busy with a lot of other things. It means you kind of gather, but there's been lots of other things going on too. So I am going to try and get back to more posts sooner. Don't expect a podcast too soon unless I find some really good subject going on. But there will be more coming along. I promise. Really, seriously, stay with me. I'm here. Anyway, thanks. I'll talk to you later.